What I want to do tonight is mostly going to concern issues that lead up to Passover, that are preparatory to Passover. Central detail that causes so much of the preparation for Passover is the difference between chametz and matzah. So first of all, let's just understand from a scientific point of view the difference between chametz and matzah. If you take flour and water and you mix it together and you let it sit, it will start to rise. The reason that it does that is because there are microorganisms in the air, spores, and they settle, and a mixture of flour and water has sugar in it. And the microorganisms convert the sugar into gas, and that the gas causes bubbles, and the bubbles cause the rising of this dough. That's the fermentation process. Okay. Now, of course, when we make bread, usually we add the yeast directly. But if you just let it stay by itself, and that's what a sourdough starter is, by the way. It's naturally occurring microorganisms that cause it to start to rise. So if you take flour and water and you mix it into a dough, and then you bake it, because the heat kills any further fermentation. So when you put it into the oven, it stops. If you take flour and water and you mix it into dough and put it into the oven, that's matzah. If you take flour and water and you let it delay, you let it sit for a while, or you do something else that causes it to start to rise, that's bread. So it's the same ingredient, it's a very slight difference in the procedure. What's so important about the difference between chametz and matzah? And in terms of Passover, that's the major issue, because on Passover, we're not allowed to eat any product that has chametz in it, and that means we have to change the food and the ingredients and the dishes, and we'll talk about all those things, but it all comes from the fact that we have to get rid of every single bit of chametz. So why is it so important to have matzah and to get rid of chametz? It's based on the narrative in the Torah. The Torah tells us as follows: the Jews were slaves in Egypt, and God said to them, I'm going to take you out. And this night of Passover, in the middle of the night, will be the plague of the firstborn. And Paro is going to say, okay, you can go free. And in the morning, the next morning, you're going to go free. So I want you to get ready, God says to the Jewish people. I want you to get ready. And when the time comes, I want you to be ready to go. And the Torah tells us that when the time came, they had dough that they would have left to bake into bread. That's the normal thing they would have done. And yet, they did not wait until the bread had baked. They simply put it on their backs and carried it with them, and it baked in the heat of the sun, and it became matzah because they did not delay the time it would take to make the dough. And that is the central defining feature of all of Passover. Let me explain what I mean. Passover is a holiday of freedom. The Jews were slaves, and on Pesach they went free. The central question you have to ask yourself is, what does it mean to be free? What does it mean? And lots of people have different answers to that question. And at different times, people have different answers to that question. What is the definition of the freedom that we celebrate? So we say, the Torah says, some people think freedom is the opportunity to do whatever you want. If you're free, that means you can sleep late, you can take it easy, you can play golf, you can do whatever you want. That's freedom. In a certain sense, it is freedom. The Jewish people, on the day that they were free, finally, after years of servitude, they could have slept late, they could have taken it easy, they could have done whatever they wanted to do. They chose to travel towards Mount Sinai without any delay, because that's what they did. They left Egypt and they went directly to Mount Sinai to be able to receive the Torah from God. In other words, the detail of the matzah reminds us why they left Egypt. The detail of the matzah reminds us what is the definition of the freedom that they achieved. It's not the definition, the definition of the freedom is not the freedom to be able to take it easy and do whatever you want. The freedom, the definition of the freedom that they achieved was the freedom to be able to travel without delay to Sinai. Without any delay. That was the definition of their freedom. Well, they knew that it would come somewhere, because remember, you know, there's this famous phrase, and we all hear it and know it, we repeat it, but in fact, it's not the full phrase. Let my people go. Right? Famous phrase, everyone knows that phrase, let my people go. There is no such phrase in the Torah. Nowhere in the Torah does it say, let my people go. Let my people go that they may serve me. It's only part of the phrase. But the phrase always continues. Moshe comes to Paro and says, God said, let my people go, shlach es ami, let my people go, v'yavdeni, so that they may serve me. It is the defining feature of the freedom that it was to go to Mount Sinai. And the emphasis on getting rid of all the chametz. And of course, because chametz is the opposite of matzah, so we want to eat matzah, and we want to get rid of all the chametz, that is how we define the nature of the freedom that we achieved. That's why it's such an important detail. And because of that detail, it's a very important rule. That's why during the holiday of Passover, we're not allowed to eat anything with chametz, even the most minute amount. It is the most strict eating rule of all of the laws about eating and not eating in the Jewish year. The laws of Passover are the most strict. And not only are we not allowed to eat something that is chametz, we're not even allowed to own something that is chametz. We're not even allowed to get benefit from something that is chametz. This is what I'm discussing so far, this is Torah law. This is biblical law. The Bible says we're not allowed to eat it, we're not allowed to own it, we're not allowed to have possession of it, we're not allowed to benefit from it anyway. And that's what causes so much of the effort and so much of the exertion of getting ready for Pesach because of this requirement. Now, so how do we achieve that? How do we get rid of every bit of chametz so that we don't eat it, we don't own it, we don't have any benefit from it? There are three processes. And it is the engaging in these three processes over the next 4 weeks that is going to keep us busy. It's these three processes. The first one is, before Pesach comes, we clean and get rid of any chametz that is in our possession. And that's the one of the large tasks in preparing for Passover, is to clean our house, our car, our office, wherever it is that we may have chametz. So, I have a criticism of the Jewish people. It's a criticism of some of you, maybe not all of you, but some of you. And that is, many Jews are guilty of too much cleaning for Pesach.
Too much.
Too much.
Okay.
And it's a very big problem. And I mean this seriously. Because in our popular Jewish culture, many people look at Pesach as something to dread, yes. Something that is overwhelming. And it's not supposed to be. I'm going to show you that it should take you between 1 and 2 hours to clean your house for Pesach. And that's it. 1 to 2 hours. Complete top for the whole house. That's it. And the problem is, if we spend hours and hours and hours and we make ourselves crazy, then we run the risk of coming to dread the holiday. And we're supposed to look forward to it. And we're not supposed to dread it. So, first of all, do not do what many people do. And that is to use your Passover cleaning as a chance to do a general spring clean. Don't make it Passover's fault that you want to organize your whole life in 1 week. Because it's not necessary for Pesach. You want to do spring cleaning, do it after Passover. Or do it in the winter, some other time. But it's not necessary for Pesach. So let's start like this. Any room where you do not take chametz during the year, you do not have to clean it. So if you have an attic, if you have a storage room, whatever rules you have within your house, if you have a room where you don't take chametz, it's not necessary to clean it. That's it. So that takes zero time. Now, in those rooms where there is chametz, the only thing that is prohibited to leave in place is if there is a piece of chametz that is the size of an olive or larger that is edible. However, if there's a piece of chametz that is, number one, smaller than the size of an olive, and number two, not going to be eaten by human beings, like individual Cheerios underneath the refrigerator, it does not have to be clean for Pesach. You're not allowed to eat it. I don't suggest eating it, but it does not have to be clean. You don't have to get rid of it. You only have to get rid of pieces of chametz that are edible and the size of an olive. And by the way, the size of an olive is approximately half the size of a hard-boiled egg. So that's the size that we're looking at. Well, you have to worry about pet food because some pet food has actual chametz in it.
Right.
So you have to have kosher for Passover pet food, which is widely available. It's not.
It is? Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, I don't have a pet, so I would.
Sure.
Really?
Sure.
The
way it goes is like this. Pet food does not have to be kosher. You can serve non-kosher foods to pets.
Right.
But it cannot be chametz.
It has to be like a new bag.
It has to be a brand that does not contain chametz. It doesn't contain grain or, you know, wheat or et cetera. So I will show you a list of kosher for Pesach dog foods.
Really?
It's a long list.
Okay.
It's a long list. It is not necessary to use a vacuum cleaner to clean for Pesach. It's not necessary. Because anything that would only be picked up by a vacuum cleaner, you don't have to clean for Pesach. It's only pieces.
Right.
So what you have to do is, you walk into the room,
yeah,
and you look around. In this room, we bring chametz. In this room, it's a dining room. So this room should take approximately 3 minutes. You walk around the room, you look and you see, are there pieces of food that are there? I'm looking around. I can't see that corner. I'll check it later. That's it. Okay, so this room is finished for Pesach. Now, if you want to do anything else, don't blame it on Pesach. But Pesach, this room takes 60 seconds. That's all. The whole house should be easily done within an hour. Those people who are cleaning between the seams of the dining room table, the dining room chairs, are doing something that is a stringency beyond what the law requires. If you're going to do it, fine, but don't blame it on Passover. Passover does not require it. You have to check the toy box. You don't have to clean it. You don't have to take every piece out. You don't have to wash every piece off. You have to open it up and look through and see if there are any whole cookies. Many people have in their house chametz, food, that they don't want to throw away or give away before Pesach. So that's even easier. Any food that you want to be able to keep and use after Pesach, you are allowed to sell it to a non-Jew during the days of Pesach. Let me explain to you how this works. First of all, you really can't do this on your own, because it's a very complicated transaction. And generally what happens is people come to a rabbi in the days before Pesach, or the weeks before Pesach, and appoint him as an agent to arrange for this sale on their behalf. What happens is you are selling the chametz that is in your house, and you're also leasing the space where it is located. So, for example, in your kitchen, if you have food in your kitchen cabinets, all you do is you sell all of that food and to the non-Jew, and all of the chametz is sold, and the place where it is resting is leased to the non-Jew. Now I'm going to explain how it works in just a moment. However, what that means is all you have to do is close the cabinets and put some kind of reminder to yourself, a piece of tape or a ribbon, that you remind yourself that that cabinet is sold. So the entire kitchen needs to take no more than 5 minutes. Because all you have to do is close the cabinet and put a sign on the cabinet. Now, yes, it's true. If you want to be able to empty out your cabinet and leave it empty and move stuff around, that's fine. But that's not for Passover. That's because of your own organizing. All that is necessary for the laws of Passover is to close it, to put a mark on it, and to arrange with the rabbi to sell the chametz. And you also don't even have to list all of the chametz that you have. And it does not have to be in any one place. It can be this cabinet, it can be this shelf in the refrigerator, it can be this part of the freezer. All that you have to do is put some kind of indicator that this part of the refrigerator, put a piece of newspaper in front of it, this part of the refrigerator is sold to the non-Jew. And it could be the cabinet here, and a kitchen, a closet here, and a shelf here. Wherever it is, it's sold. So how does it work? So let me explain to you how it works. Some people say, and again, let me just make clear so that we're not misunderstanding, any area that you close up and you're selling to the non-Jew, you don't have to clean anything inside. Because whatever chametz is there is being sold. So no work whatsoever is necessary for that. Now, how does it work? Some people say, well, it's like a legal fiction because, you know, I mean, you're not really selling it. I mean, the non-Jew is not really coming into your house and you buy it back after Pesach. It sounds a little fishy. So let me explain to you how it works because, in my opinion, it is not fishy at all. In my opinion, it is a legal, logical, rational method. Let me explain how it works. The way we do it is like this. I'll just use myself as an example. Different people come to me, and they appoint me as their agent, and they say to me, I have chametz, here's my address, I have it here, and I have it here, it's in the kitchen, it's in there, and wherever it may be, and I want you, Rabbi Whitman, to sell the chametz for me. So I have a contract with each person, and it gives all the details of how this works. Now I have a stack of these contracts. I have, I don't know, a couple of hundred of these contracts of different people, different families. So I sit down with a non-Jewish person on the morning before Pesach. And I say to him, here's what we want to do. I want you to purchase all of the chametz that is indicated in all of these sheets and all of these contracts and all of these homes. And that means the chametz will belong to you. That means that theoretically you have the right to go into any one of these houses and take and go into the cabinet where the chametz is and to take it. And if you do, write down what you've taken. Hold on for a moment. And you also are leasing the space where it is located. So let's say you need storage space. Let's say you want to store something. You can go to any one of those closets or cabinets or shelves and you can put your stuff there because you're leasing it. And then I say to him, so how do we figure out how much it costs? Well, it's kind of a big headache to figure out how much it costs. So what we say as follows. We say, I'll take a down payment. You give me a down payment, and then later on, we'll figure it out. Okay? But the down payment means that you own it right now. And he agrees, and there's all kinds of legal language and ceremony that we use. Now, after the holiday, we go back to the non-Jew. We say, listen, you have two choices. The two choices are like this. You already bought the chametz. It belongs to you. You've owned it now for 8 days. By the way, if you took any from anyone's house, you wrote down what it was, so you have to pay the fair market value. If he comes into my house and takes a half a bag of flour and 3/4 of a bottle of scotch, whatever it is. And so we have a Betdin, which is a Jewish court, a panel of three judges, and they will evaluate the fair market value of each item that was taken, and they're going to pay, and he's going to pay me for it. Of course I agree to that. I would agree to that. You're going to come and take some of my half-opened food, and you're going to pay me for it. So absolutely, I agree wholeheartedly. Because by agreeing to that, it means that you, the non-Jew, own it during Pesach, and I have saved myself from the prohibition of owning chametz and from the loss of throwing it away. So you're going to pay me fair market value. Now, let's say the non-Jew doesn't go into anybody's home. So after the holiday, I go over to the non-Jew, I say, okay, it's now time to fish or cut bait. You have two choices. Either you can pay me the balance of what you owe and then take all the chametz. So that means we go to each person's house and we make up a list of exactly what you have, fair market value, and the non-Jew pays you in cash directly the fair market value of how much it is. Or, if you want, non-Jewish sir or madam, I'm willing, on behalf of all those people, to buy it back from you. Normally, he says, okay, he sells it back, and now it's returned to your ownership. You didn't have to move it. You didn't receive any money. I, as your agent, receive the down payment, and then I use that to buy it back afterwards, so there's no net transfer of assets. So you didn't have to move it. You didn't have to clean there. And you did not legally own it during Passover, and it is completely valid 100% in a legal manner. So it's one of the greatest things since sliced bread, but since chopped liver.
What do you do?
If someone would come into your refrigerator and take out something and say, I'm going to pay you for it, it's purely logical.
Yeah.
How many times has it happened that the person actually comes and takes?
I do know a case...
And this is a very serious problem. I do know a case, Nebuch, it's very sad, where after Passover was over, the rabbi went to find the non-Jew and could not find him because Nebuch, he had had a heart attack and he was in the hospital and no one knew. And that's a very serious problem. So we hope and pray for the health and well-being of the non-Jewish person. Now, you can arrange for the sale with your local rabbi anytime between now and Passover, between now and the morning before Passover. The rabbi will sit down with a non-Jewish person usually early in the morning of the day before Passover. That's usually when the sale takes place. So you have to arrange it before that time in order to be included. But it's perfectly legal, it's perfectly rational, and it saves you a whole lot of work. So those are two of the processes that allow for Pesach to be, preparing for Pesach to be an hour or less, your entire house. Now, we're not finished. On the night before Passover, we are required to search our home, to check and to make sure that we have cleaned it properly, the way that I described, and we want to make sure that, and again, we're only looking for pieces the size of an olive or larger that are edible, but we want to make sure we didn't overlook anything. And the only chametz that should remain is one of two types. Either the chametz that is put away that is going to be sold the next morning, so that we can let stay there, because as of the next morning it will not be there. We also have the custom that before we search for chametz, we put out, or one member of the family puts out 10 pieces of chametz hidden around the house, so that while you're searching, you find those 10 pieces. If you put out 10 pieces and you only find 9, then it's going to take longer than an hour because you can't go to sleep until you find it, because you know that there's chametz there, and you know it's larger than the size of an olive, and you're going to have to find it. So that could be a real problem. The purpose of that is so that those 10 pieces that you find, you put aside, and the next morning, that's the morning of the eve of Pesach, we burn those pieces. Before I go any further, let me just say it is necessary to burn it in a safe manner. And it's very important that it be done in a safe manner. We burn it. And the reason that we burn it, let's just think back to the symbolism of what does it mean. We are burning the last pieces of chametz that are in our possession in order to, again, emphasize that we are getting rid of chametz and we are only eating matzah for the next 7 or 8 days, and thereby we are defining the freedom that we are going to celebrate on Pesach. That is, we don't want just to get rid of the chametz, we want to clean it, we want to have a ceremony where we are actively removing it from our ownership. And that's why we search for it, and we leave out the pieces to be able to find, and then we burn them the next morning, and we then remind ourselves what it is that we're going to be celebrating this night. So that's two processes. One is cleaning, and the other is selling. There's a third process. And the third process is even easier. If the others take a total of an hour, maybe, this takes 60 seconds. And it's called bitul. Bitul is a Hebrew word, and it means nullification. And it's a declaration. It's a statement that we make. We actually say it twice. If you look in the Haggadah, at night, the night before Pesach, when we finish searching for chametz, we say it once. And then the next day, when we burn the chametz, in the morning before Pesach, we say it again. And the declaration goes like this. The one that we say during the day goes like this. Any chametz that may be in my possession, I forgot to clean it, I forgot to sell it, I forgot, I didn't know about it, I didn't realize, whatever mistake I might have made, I hereby relinquish my ownership to it and declare it null and void and meaningless. There's a legal principle. The legal principle goes like this. If I own something, let's say this belongs to me, I own something. So if I want, I could give it to somebody else. I could just relinquish my own ownership. I can say, this is Hefker. It doesn't belong to me anymore. Then, whoever picks it up first, it'll belong to. But I can remove my ownership over any object that belongs to me. And I can do that with chametz. And I can make a blanket declaration to say, I am nullifying, I am declaring insignificant and ownerless any chametz that may be in my possession. And this is a very important idea. Because the reason we do bitul is that we realize a person can make a mistake. No matter how hard a person tries, we don't expect perfection. I might have forgotten to clean something. I might have made a mistake in the way I sold the chametz. I might have done something else wrong. Who knows what I might have done wrong? Therefore, I have bitul. It's a last resort. It means that it's removed from my ownership. And that means I can't violate the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach, because by definition it was removed from my ownership. It doesn't belong to me.
You're making sure.
Making sure. It's just like it's a security blanket. It's covering all the bases. But it reminds us of a very important lesson about Judaism in general, and that is, I'm supposed to try as hard as I can, and yet I should not expect that I'm going to do it perfectly. I'm going to make a mistake. Everyone makes mistakes from time to time in every area. And that's why, when it's really serious, because it's a very serious prohibition to own chametz on Pesach, so we have a safety net to take care of that problem. But a person should realize, when a person realizes that they've made a mistake, okay, a person can feel bad and want to try harder in the future, but a person should realize everyone makes mistakes. And it's understandable to make mistakes. And we expect that we will make mistakes. That's part of life. that part of the preparing for Pesach, and yes, there's still a little bit more to do. We're not finished yet. But that part of preparing for Pesach literally should not take more than an hour to prepare for Pesach. You have to make sure that on Pesach we are not allowed to eat chametz. Chametz is very hard to find, especially with processed foods. In some form, it's in everything. And especially today, as food technology gets more complicated, hydrolyzed wheat protein, I mean, different forms of grains are in different products. So basically speaking, the general rule is all food needs to be kosher for Pesach. The VAD publishes a guide that lists all the foods under their supervision. They also list a number of items that are intrinsically kosher for Pesach that do not have to have any special symbol. And everything, especially here, everything is widely available. It is not difficult to get any kosher for Pesach product. Anything that you want is going to be. So you have to make sure that every ingredient is kosher for Pesach. Okay, so that's a certain amount of work. Depending on how much you have, the easiest thing is you could just close the cabinets, put the mark on it, sell everything there, and then you go to the grocery store and you buy kosher for Pesach items, and you use that. So again, there's no extra effort involved. Not only must the ingredients be kosher, but also the utensils must be kosher for Pesach. Because if you have utensils that are used during the year, they have absorbed the particles of the chametz food, and they will impart that flavor on Pesach, and that will be the same as eating small amounts of chametz on Pesach. And therefore, we have to be concerned about the utensils that we cook food in and that we serve food in to prepare for Pesach. Now, the easiest method, well, the easiest method is go to Florida. But the second easiest method is if you have separate utensils for Pesach. So if you have a separate set of dishes and separate pots and pans and separate glasses and separate this and separate that, so all you do is you close the cabinets for the year-round stuff, and you open the cabinets for the other. Yes, of course, if you have Pesach utensils and they're stored downstairs in the basement and you have no room for them, so you have to schlep everything out of the cabinets and then schlep it upstairs and put it inside, and yes, that can be a lot of work. Yes, admittedly, that can be a lot of work, but that's not because of Pesach. That's because you didn't put in Passover cabinets in your kitchen. But don't blame it on Pesach. That's my point.
Okay.
Don't blame it on Pesach. It's not because of Pesach. You want to store it downstairs, so you're going to have to work harder. When you redesign your kitchen, you put in a Pesach cabinet. So the easiest thing is just to switch utensils. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to do anything. You just close one cabinet and open the other cabinet. The second choice is to kosher the year-round utensils in order to be able to use them for Pesach. Okay, so now we're getting to a little bit of time and effort. But remember, it's not necessary to do because of Pesach, it's just because you want to use the same stuff. Now, I want to explain to you the concept of kosher, because it's very simple. And once you understand the principle of how it works, all of the details are much easier to understand. And the basic principle is the same whether we're talking about koshering for Pesach, hello, good evening, or whether we're talking about koshering during the year from non-kosher to kosher. It's the same principle. There are differences in the details, but the principle is the same. And it goes like this. Let's take a simple example. Let's take a pot. And you cook food in the pot. Now, there are two parts to this food. The first is called be'en, food that is on the surface. If there's food that is on the surface of the utensil, then it's got to be removed. There's no way to kosher it. It's got to be removed. It has to be cleaned and removed. Because if you leave it there, it's going to cook into the next thing that you cook, obviously. That's why we wash our dishes in between using them. However, in addition to what is be'en on the surface, there's also balua. Balua means what is absorbed. And the way it works is like this. Let's just take the example of a big pot in which you make soup, make chicken soup. So it's a metal pot. You put water, you put chicken and other things in. You heat it up. When you heat it up, the metal is porous. And the metal expands. And when the metal expands, the particles of food are absorbed into the wall of the utensil. If you cook chicken soup, and then you empty out the pot, so there's no be'en, there's no food on the surface, and then you take clean water, and you boil the water, it will have the residue of the chicken soup that you cooked before. Why? Because the particles of food have been absorbed into the walls of the utensil. When you heat it, when it cools off, the particles are trapped in the wall of the utensil. The next time you heat it up, the particles are released into the new mixture. So they are flavoring the new mixture. And by the way, you can see this. If you do this with chicken soup, you make chicken soup in a pot, wash it, rinse it out with cold water, fill it with water, and bring it to a boil, you'll see the on the surface, you'll see the scum on the surface. It comes from before.
Yeah, the shine.
That's what would be the problem. If you have a pot and you cook chametz, the chametz is absorbed. If on Pesach you cook something in the same pot, the chametz is released into it and flavors the food, and now you're eating chametz on Pesach. So therefore, kashering is very simple. Kashering means the process by which we remove the absorbed particles. That's all it is. It's purely scientific. There are no blessings, there's no ritual, there's no spirituality. It's just scientific. How do you remove the absorbed particles of food? Now, the way it works is like this. Every utensil is different, and it depends on how, what it's made of, and it depends on how it's used. For example, let's take that chicken soup pot. So it absorbed the particles of food by boiling liquid in it. The way it releases it is by boiling water in it to allow the food to be released, and then you throw it out and rinse it out. So one method of kashering something is by putting it into boiling water. And the procedure is you take a utensil, you have to clean it because there cannot be any food on the surface, and then you immerse it in boiling water for a long enough time till it gets hot, let's say 15 seconds. That means it expands, it releases the particles, and it's now kosher. You've removed what is absorbed. Another method is by direct heat. Let's say you take your oven and you turn your oven on the self-cleaning cycle. What that effectively does is any food particles that would have been absorbed into the walls of the oven are burned by that heat. So you have burned the particles that may remain there. There is a concept that many people have heard of putting a utensil in dirt. And that is, you'll excuse me if I say that it's humorous, only because it's such a strange misunderstanding. And people think it's an old wives' tale or a superstition. It's nothing of the sort. The Talmud says that if you have a utensil that was used for something non-kosher, and you want to clean it off, you use a scouring pad to remove the food. But at the time of the Talmud, they didn't have a scouring pad. You know what they had? They had hard earth. If you take a knife and you plunge it in, you're not doing anything mystical with it. You're using the hard earth to clean off the residue. That's all it does. So again, in terms of kashering for Passover, the more stuff you want to kasher, of course, the more time it's going to take, because each utensil and each material has to be kashered differently. For example, you should be able to see very simply that if you use something with hot food, you have to kasher it one way. But if you only use something with cold food, you never use it with hot food, it's going to be much easier to kasher because nothing gets absorbed. Particles of food are absorbed only in the presence of heat. If something is only used cold, you just have to wash it with soap and water. So the method of koshering depends on what the utensil was and also what the material is, because there's some materials that cannot be koshered. For example, china. The problem with china is it is porous, it does absorb, but to put it in hot enough water will cause it to crack, or maybe cause it to crack, and I'm not willing to take any chances with your dishes. So therefore, we're worried that it can't be done properly. That's why we can't kosher certain materials. Even if you have separate utensils, many people still have to kosher their oven and their stove and the countertops and the sink and these kinds of things. I would suggest that we leave that for the time being, and I'd be glad to discuss with each individual exactly how to go about it. Of course, it does take a little bit more time, but koshering the oven is very easy. It just means going through the self-clean cycle twice. And, koshering the stovetop is usually very easy. And if a person is going to kosher utensils, you are talking about a couple of hours of work. That is true. And those things have to be taken care of. So again, I want to go back to what I said before. The whole house, yes. Yes.
And I said, whatever you said, that's what I'm doing. Okay.
Should not take more than an hour. Unless you are planning to kosher a lot of utensils, in which case it will take more time. Or unless you have to move stuff around because you don't have convenient access to the stuff you need for Pesach, that will take more time. But in terms of what the holiday requires, it is very, very minimal. And again, I want to emphasize, it is the right thing to make use of this standard in order not to dread the coming of Pesach. I want to just mention one last thing, and then I'd be happy to take questions or discussion. There is one more mitzvah that applies in the weeks before Pesach, and that is the mitzvah of Ma'os Chitim. Ma'os Chitim literally means money for flour, and it means to provide financial support for needy Jews so that they will be able to afford the flour necessary to bake matzah for Pesach. In other words, to be able to make sure that every Jew can afford to celebrate Pesach. And there are many organizations in our community, in almost every community, there are organizations that collect funds for Ma'os Chitim campaign, and they'll collect either money or food, and they will give out money or give out food directly. B'nai B'rith gives out food packages and other organizations. And it's a very important practice to make sure that because Pesach is so important, every Jew should be able to participate, and every Jew, even the neediest Jew, should have the rudiments necessary to celebrate Pesach. So that's another mitzvah we should make sure that we fulfill during these days before Pesach.